Tonight, we're breaking down the latest developments surrounding the fight against the coronavirus, specifically the various treatment options available and the status of the ongoing vaccine development and clinical trials as well.
In recent months, but especially in the last few days with President Trump in the hospital, we've heard names like remdesivir and dexamethasone used frequently and mentioned as potential COVID-19 treatments.
Tonight, we are bringing you just the facts about the virus, the treatments available, and how doctors feel about them as a long-term option.
And also when we can expect to see a vaccine readily available for nationwide distribution. So we begin all of this with the treatments currently utilized around the country, both in hospitals and by people quarantining at home. Over-the-counter options available at local pharmacies, antiviral medications, including remdesivir, and steroids like dexamethasone. We reached out to two infectious disease experts to talk about these treatments, including Dr. Dean Winslow, professor of medicine at Stanford University Medical Center with more than 40 years of experience, and Dr. Nasha Safdar, a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin's Division of Infectious Disease. Dr. Safdar also received the President's Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers, the highest honor the U.S. government can bestow on scientists beginning their careers. We wanted to know, what are the best current treatments available right now? Here's what the experts had to say.
So one of the concerns, though, is when you use inappropriate or rather unproven treatments, I should say, is that you may delay using more proven types of treatments. But as I said, you know, we do have a number of very interesting compounds in clinical trials right now, which, again, I feel very, very strongly that it's critically important that we complete those trials, you know, so we get a definite answer.
So the cocktails are monoclonal, meaning that there's a specific concentration of antibodies against COVID. So with much more targeted, much more focused, whereas the convalescent plasma will have antibodies to, you know, whatever else in addition to COVID. And you don't always know how much anti-COVID antibodies there are in there. So convalescent plasma is plasma obtained from people with COVID who have since recovered. And the idea is that those individuals will have high volume and high concentration of antibodies in their plasma, which if you give it to somebody who has COVID could potentially help their clinical course. And I think there's good data to support that it's helpful. How helpful it is, I think there's still some clinical trials ongoing, but most of our patients who are getting hospitalized are receiving convalescent plasma, and there is an emergency use authorization for it.
We also wanted to know, what should someone do if they learn they have tested positive for COVID-19? How does that process change if the case is mild or moderate or more severe? And how should we behave around people who have tested positive?
If you have been exposed to someone with documented COVID-19 infection, I think it's very prudent for you to self-isolate for 14 days. I think that's the first step. And of course, I think it's also very important that if you are in the presence of someone else and you're still awaiting test results and you're self-quarantining, you really should wear a face covering to prevent you from potentially spreading the virus to other people. So I think those are two of the things that are very important. I would recommend that you get tested probably no sooner than about 3 days after exposure, probably around 4 or 5 days is actually optimal. And then if you are confirmed positive, and particularly if you develop symptoms, I think one thing that is actually probably a good idea to have, if you have the resources to afford that, would be to monitor yourself with what's called a pulse oximeter, so you can actually measure your oxygen concentrations. And certainly if you are otherwise healthy and you develop oxygen saturation, certainly down in the low 90s, or you're symptomatically short of breath, you really should seek medical attention, because you probably should be hospitalized, as apparently the president was last weekend.
Turning now to the treatments available, and of course we've heard a lot about remdesivir, dexamethasone, and hydroxychloroquine, but most of those are meant for patients with more serious cases of COVID-19. For many people who test positive, their symptoms can be treated actually with over-the-counter options.
So there's really not a lot of good evidence that someone taking zinc or vitamin D will influence the course of their infection. It's actually been known, though, for quite a long time that individuals who are truly deficient in vitamin D may be more susceptible to more severe illness from a variety of pathogens, including viruses. So it certainly doesn't hurt to take some supplemental zinc or vitamin D, but I would like to emphasize that there's no real good clinical evidence to support the efficacy of either of those compounds.
Yeah, melatonin, I think, is one of those things that people use because it has some immune modulatory, potentially antioxidant properties, but again, pretty broad in terms of how it might work. So relatively harmless. I don't typically recommend it at this point since we don't quite know how it works and how well it works. But I know people use it for all kinds of things outside of COVID.
Now, these are some of the over-the-counter options available and that were administered to President Trump as well. While experts say none of them has yet proven to be effective treatments for COVID-19, some of them have been shown to effectively manage the symptoms at the very least. The only warnings doctors are working to spread are about vitamin D, which the Cleveland Clinic says should not be recommended to patients with coronavirus, and aspirin, which experts say should not be used by asymptomatic patients as they may hide symptoms. Experts say you should use aspirin as a coronavirus treatment only if instructed by a doctor.
For patients with more serious cases, some of the more frequently used drugs are remdesivir and dexamethasone, both of which were administered to the president. Here's what we know about remdesivir. It earned FDA emergency use authorization to be used on hospitalized coronavirus patients only. That's partially because the supply is so limited. If approved as a widespread treatment, experts estimate it could cost approximately $520 per vial. A recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine found remdesivir did shorten recovery time for COVID-19 patients, but experts are still working to reach a definitive conclusion.
There are, you know, data to support certainly very strongly that remdesivir will shorten the duration of hospitalization. Although the trial was stopped before that some of the secondary endpoints of that trial were met, I think most of us that have treated large numbers of patients with COVID-19 feel very strongly that remdesivir, you know, helps in terms of reducing the severity of illness and not only improving people's ability to recover quickly, but probably also keeping people who may have been on the borderline, from requiring mechanical ventilation or going to the ICU and having a breathing tube put down. So I think that's very, very important, and again, most of us feel remdesivir is a very critical antiviral in our armamentarium. Thing I would like to emphasize, though, is with dexamethasone, that where it was shown to be helpful in this large British trial was mainly in people with moderate to severe disease, and actually individuals with very mild COVID-19 showed actually somewhat worse outcomes.
The other drug that we've heard mentioned recently, the doctor just brought it up there, dexamethasone, doctors administered to President Trump after they say his oxygen levels dropped over the weekend. We know dexamethasone is an anti-inflammatory steroid. It is recommended for patients who do not need supplemental oxygen. Clinical trial results concluded that the steroid did benefit critically ill, hospitalized COVID-19 patients. And while the experts we spoke to expressed cautious optimism about dexamethasone's use as a coronavirus therapy, they did say that the data they have so far is not enough to make a definitive conclusion.
So for moderate case, you would likely need to seek medical care. You might get supplemental oxygen. You would get steroids. Dexamethasone, for instance, is now standard of care for those with moderate to severe illness. And you would still get the usual supportive care plus remdesivir. You might also be a candidate for convalescent plasma, which is plasma obtained from individuals who have recovered from COVID. And that's also something that has an emergency use authorization for it.
We do recommend using remdesivir as early as practical in most patients with documented COVID-19 infections who have symptoms or who are sick enough to require hospitalization. And it was also shown a few months ago in a trial that was done very rapidly in the United Kingdom that dexamethasone, which is a corticosteroid type drug, is helpful in patients with moderate to severe COVID-19 infection.
Shifting now to the latest details surrounding the ongoing efforts to develop a vaccine. There we go. We've gotten mixed messages about when we can expect a reliable vaccine to be rolled out, with some estimating that one could be ready by the end of the year, others saying it could be middle to late next year. We spoke to Dr. Amesh Ajala, assistant professor and senior scholar, Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. Dr. Ajala is also an advisor to the U.S. government on infectious disease emergencies. Here's what he had to say about the current status of the vaccine development and trials.
It's going to be a very daunting process to distribute this vaccine. You're talking about a two-dose vaccine for 350 million or more people. So that's 700 million doses. It's going to be something that requires cold storage. So there is going to be a lot of logistical issues there. And that's why you're seeing the U.S. military be involved and other companies be involved in trying to figure out how they're going to get a vaccine that's developed into the arms of Americans. Because if it doesn't get distributed well, it's of no use. We have to get it into people. So this is going to be something that's very daunting and takes a lot of coordination, and it's going to be something that will likely stretch well into 2021 in the best case scenario. Some of these vaccines require what's called an ultra cold chain that has to be kept very, very cold, like around minus 70 degrees centigrade. So in order to do that, you're going to have large freezers available. And when you take the vaccine out of those large storage freezers, they can only remain viable for a couple of hours in an ordinary fridge. So that's going to limit how much supply is available at a doctor's office or at a drugstore. And we're going to continually need to replenish that stock from large storage containers that are able to keep that cold temperature. The average person can expect to get a vaccine well into 2021, perhaps the summer of 2021. They may be able to get it at their doctor's office, but more likely people are going to probably have to go to a health department clinic that might be set up where people may stand in line and get a vaccine, similar to what happened during H1N1, because logistically it's going to be hard to deliver and we have this cold storage issue. So it may be the easiest way to do this will be with health departments setting up common clinics where people can get vaccinated.
According to the World Health Organization, there are more than 190 vaccine candidates in development. 42 of those candidate vaccines are in human trials, while 151 remain in preclinical evaluation.
Developing a successful vaccine is only half the battle. From there, health authorities around the world will have to formulate a comprehensive plan for distributing the vaccine to those who need it most. And as Dr. Ajala explained, vaccine distribution is sometimes easier said than done.
We're making rapid progress towards a vaccine, but you have to remember that vaccine development is usually something we measure in years, not months. And although Operation Warp Speed has catapulted several different vaccines into phase three clinical trials, there's still some time to go. And it will likely be well into 2021 before the general public, if everything goes perfect, has access to a vaccine. Healthcare workers, there's a chance maybe by the end of 2020 that there could be some limited supplies of a certain vaccine available for them. But again, this is something that we have to hope for, but have to expect won't necessarily meet specific deadlines. Well, there are many different vaccine candidates in different clinical trial phases. There are several that are in phase three, the ones that you hear headlines about, like Moderna or AstraZeneca or Pfizer. Those are all in phase three clinical trials, which are the last phase. That's where you figure out, does this vaccine work and is it safe in tens of thousands of people? But there are other vaccines kind of at the back of the pack that are in earlier phases of clinical development. And some of those may actually prove to be promising, but our first vaccines are likely to probably emerge from this group that's in the phase three trials now.
And those health experts say developing and distributing a vaccine is not the end of the road. Doctors say they must vaccinate a certain percentage of the population for the vaccine to even be effective, but they expect that to be a challenge.
For this vaccine to be highly impactful, we want to get probably 80% of the population vaccinated, because otherwise we won't be near that herd immunity threshold. And you have to remember, we have to put in a buffer because not everybody is going to have an appropriate reaction to the vaccine. Some people, the vaccine might not take. So we want to get above that herd immunity threshold to make sure that we have enough immunity in the community so that the virus finds it much harder to infect and harm people. With two-dose vaccines, they're usually separated by 2 to 3 weeks. So that also adds another logistical layer to this, that you have to make sure that you're bringing people back because the vaccine won't be effective without that second dose. So that makes it even harder to deliver this vaccine. It's going to be extremely important to emphasize the need for this vaccine when we have the data that show it to be safe and effective. We're going to have to do basically public health detailing, because if the general public doesn't accept this vaccine, it will not be useful. And we will still be fighting this virus with the same tools that we have today. So we have to remember that there is a vaccine hesitancy and an anti-vaccine movement that are already poised to attack this vaccine even before it's available. So we have to be armed with the facts and the correct information and really be able to debunk the myths that are already starting to arise about these vaccines.